call the case of Betty Ho versus State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company 97-0659. Thomas Antoine representing Betty Ho.
May I please the court? I am Virginia Antoine of the law firm of Havish Davis and Rotier, and I represent Betty Hull. Mrs. Hull's husband was killed when he was struck by a pickup truck. The driver of the pickup truck was covered by liability insurance. However, the owner of the truck was not covered by any insurance, and in fact, the vehicle itself was not covered by insurance. Mrs. Hull claims that the owner of the pickup truck was negligent in failing to properly maintain the truck, and she asserts that she is entitled to collect damages caused by the negligence of the owner. She contends that the motor vehicle, the pickup truck, was uninsured, and she's brought suit against her uninsured motorist carrier. The issue here is whether the pickup truck was an uninsured motor vehicle. I think that the starting point for resolving this question is the language of the State Farm policies. The policies define an uninsured motor vehicle as a land motor vehicle, the ownership, maintenance, or use of which is not insured for bodily injury. In this case, the maintenance of the truck was not insured for bodily injury, and therefore we believe that the truck falls within the definition of uninsured motor vehicle in the policy. However, the Court of Appeals disagreed and held that the issue of whether the vehicle was an uninsured motor vehicle was controlled by the definition of uninsured motor vehicle, which it had adopted in the Hammerly case. There it defined uninsured motor vehicle to include a vehicle, neither the owner nor the operator of which was insured by liability insurance, and so concluded that because the driver in this case was covered by insurance, the truck could not be an uninsured motor vehicle. I think the principal issue here is whether the Hammerly definition of uninsured motor vehicle is controlling. It's the position of Mrs. Hull that that definition cannot be controlling, not only because this case is factually distinguishable from the Hammerly case, but because to apply the definition of uninsured motor vehicle would defeat the purpose of the uninsured motor statute. This court has interpreted the statute to mean that the purpose of the statute is to provide a person injured by an uninsured motorist with the same protection that that injured person would have if he or she were injured by a motorist which is covered by liability insurance. In this case, if the owner of the pickup truck had been covered by liability insurance, that insurance would be available to Mrs. Hull to provide compensation for the damages caused by the owner of the vehicle. And that coverage would be available regardless of whether the driver of the vehicle was also covered by insurance.
Ms. Antoine, let me interrupt if I might and ask you this. You just mentioned that this particular case was factually different than the Hammerly case. Can you tell us what you meant by that statement? How is it factually different?
In this case, both the driver and the owner of the vehicle are claimed to be negligent and negligent tortfeasors. In the Hammerly case, only the driver was claimed to be negligent, and he had insurance coverage covering his negligence. I think that's essentially why the Court of Appeals determined that there was no uninsured motorist coverage available. Also, in this case, I think the policy language is different and distinguishable from the policy language in the Hammerly case. In the Hammerly case, the Court of Appeals found an ambiguity in the policy language because the title of the uninsured motorist coverage provision used the words uninsured motorist. But then in the actual language of the policy, which was in dispute, it used the term uninsured motor vehicle. So the Court of Appeals thought that there was an ambiguity in using both the term uninsured motorist and uninsured motor vehicle. And then it went on to resolve that ambiguity in accordance with the way it had defined uninsured motor vehicle as it interpreted the statute. In this case, the language of the policy only uses the term uninsured motor vehicle. It says that an uninsured motor vehicle is a vehicle the ownership, maintenance, or use of which is not insured. Here the maintenance is not insured, so I think that there should be coverage under the policy.
Well, let me ask you about what I understand the situation. Apparently, this case involves only a claim against State Farm under the uninsured motorist portions of the two State Farm policies that the Hulls have. There's a second case pending, and that's a case pending against the driver and the driver's insurance carrier through the employer. Is that indeed the case?
Yes.
Do the pleadings in this particular case, in the case that's before us today, in any way make reference to the negligence of the driver?
No. Initially, when we brought the claim against State Farm, we thought that the owner of the vehicle was primarily negligent, and that's why the claim was initially brought against State Farm only under the uninsured motorist coverage. The action against the driver and his insurance company was later filed because the statute of limitations was running, and since the case against State Farm had been dismissed, we wanted to preserve Mrs. Hull's rights, so we started a lawsuit against the driver and his employer and the employer's insurance carrier.
And obviously you want us to take into account the fact that there are two actions pending.
Well,
in other words, you want us to take into account the fact that you have made allegations against the driver in one suit and against the owner in regard to maintenance concerning this particular action.
Well, I don't think...
If you're not asking us to do that, then how is this factually distinguishable from Hemmerly and from, I think the other case is Schwackert? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but the case coming out of this court that you distinguished on a factual basis in your brief.
Well, I don't think it's necessary for you to consider the fact that the driver was insured and that a lawsuit was brought against it. Mr. Farb filed a petition to supplement the record. I oppose that because the issue as to whether this is an uninsured motor vehicle or not, I don't think is governed by whether the driver has coverage or not. But I think that this case is somewhat factually distinguishable from Hemmerly, because in Hemmerly, the driver was the one that was claimed to be negligent. He was the only tortfeasor,
and the owner. And here, in this particular case, your claim is the owner was negligent in terms of maintenance. Is that not right?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you what I think is the importance of these questions a little differently. In an ideal world for your client, using the statute and the policy, would it be your position that if any one person that could be allegedly negligent does not have insurance, even if you might have four other tortfeasors there that do have insurance, if any one of them that doesn't have insurance, you can fall within the uninsured motorist policy?
Well, I think you first have to look at the language of the policy.
Well, let's take this language of this policy.
So if there were two or three other
people that were
also negligent.
Yeah, there may have a number of people that are negligent in it. Some have insurance, some don't. If you followed Hemmerly, you might get to a scene that you never can fall under uninsured motorist because there's somebody out there who's negligent that has coverage.
Yes.
right?
Right.
Okay. And it seems to me that your position is, if there's somebody out there who's allegedly negligent, and I don't mean unknown, but unknown negligent person, that even if you have another tortfeasor that has coverage, under this language and under the statute, uninsured motorist comes into play. Now, you might lose, and I mean, the owner may not be negligent, so that's the end of that. But
that is our position.
That is your position,
yes.
But it has to arise out of the ownership, maintenance, or use.
Under the way this policy is worded, yes.
Right, and under the statute.
Yes.
And here you're saying that it's the ownership.
The ownership is uninsured.
And well, so I guess, following up on the chief's question, let's assume that the owner had taken the car in to get it maintained the day before and was told that it was fixed and it wasn't. The guy that maintained it was negligent in failing to fix the brakes. And the guy that fixed the brakes, that was supposed to fix the brakes, didn't have insurance. You're saying that if I'm injured, I can rely on my uninsured motorist coverage with respect to the maintenance man for failing to maintain the car?
No, I don't think so. Under the language of the policy, the policy...
What does the word maintenance mean then?
Pardon?
What does the word maintenance mean? Arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use? Where does that come into play? Maintenance.
Well, I think in this case the owner was negligent in failing to properly maintain the truck. And the claim...
I understand your position here. I'm trying to draw this out because of, you know, you got to stop it somewhere.
No, if he took it to a garage,
yeah,
and the garage man didn't fix it properly.
Right, and the garage man doesn't have insurance.
Well, under the language of the policy, he could not be uninsured. There could be no coverage because they will only provide coverage for bodily injury to insured if he is legally entitled to collect from the owner or the driver of the vehicle.
But under the statute, it doesn't limit it. The statute does not limit that as such, does it? 632.32 does not.
Well, the statute says that that uninsured motorist coverage should provide protection for owners or operators of uninsured motor vehicles.
Okay. I was looking at 32.4, but I don't have the statute in front of me.
This is standard language, isn't it, in many policies?
Yes.
And in some states, an owner is liable if the just by mere fact of ownership if the car gets into an accident.
Yes, in some states.
But that's not in Wisconsin.
No.
So if this is, you think that's what the standard language of this policy means? That it applies in states where the owner might be liable? I mean, if I drove in, and I'm sorry, I don't know which state this applies in, but let's assume it's Illinois, where the owner is liable and I gave my car to somebody, and I'd be liable just for ownership. That language might cover, rather than maintain.
Do I think that there would be coverage then?
Yeah.
I think so, yes.
So what's your biggest stumbling block, Hemmerly?
Pardon?
What's your biggest stumbling block to win, Hemmerly? Statute? The word or?
I think the biggest stumbling block is the Hemmerly case because the Court of Appeals thought that was controlling. I believe that Hemmerly should not be controlling here because to apply the definition of uninsured motor vehicle adopted in Hemmerly would defeat the purpose of the uninsured motor statute. Because the way the court has interpreted...
And what is that purpose as you define it?
The purpose is to protect a person injured by the negligence of an uninsured motorist, to provide them with the same protection they would have if that motorist had carried liability insurance.
If the motorist or if the negligent tortfeasor?
Well, if the tortfeasor, that's what I meant. you...
That's an important distinction, though, for your case.
Yes. You had said Hammerly doesn't apply. You earlier said it doesn't apply because it defeats the purpose and the factual distinction. Tell me again the significant factual distinction why Hammerly doesn't apply in this case.
Well, in the Hammerly case, the driver who was claimed to be at fault.
And there was one tortfeasor in that case. It was a guest passenger, is that right? Or am I wrong?
It was a driver who was driving somebody else's vehicle.
And the guest passenger was injured?
Yes. And in that case, the driver was covered by liability insurance. So, essentially, there was no coverage because the Court of Appeals reasoned that there's coverage... There was liability coverage for the one who ought to pay. In this case, there's no liability coverage for the person who we believe ought to pay, and that is the owner.
Okay, well, let me say in this case, what if you have the same facts with the exception of driver gets into the car, our facts, and there's a little yellow sticker on the vehicle that says, careful, brakes not properly working. Then you have a strong argument on negligence of the driver. Does that make any difference?
As to whether there's coverage for the owner?
Yeah. I mean, you're saying liability for one who ought to pay. In our fact situation here, there is coverage for the driver. And as modified by my hypothetical, he arguably would have some negligence because there's a warning and he still did it. You know, that doesn't mean that the owner doesn't have negligence too, but I mean it's a much sharper case for negligence of the driver. Does that hypothetical change
my position?
Yeah.
No. I mean, even if there are two people who are claimed to be negligent, and one of them does have liability insurance, if the other one does not, I think that there should be uninsured motorist coverage.
The uninsured motorist coverage should be treated like the negligent tortfeasor who was not insured. You're just putting the uninsured motorist coverage into the same spot as the alleged negligent tortfeasor.
Essentially, yes.
Essentially, you are. And so if you had four people, all of whom could be negligent, all of whom could be sued, one of whom is uninsured, you're saying the uninsured motorist coverage comes into play.
Yes.
Could I ask, if the petition for review had not been granted, you have a lawsuit against the driver, and you would be continuing to go after the driver, is that right?
Yes.
And you have to establish the negligence of the driver, is that correct?
We have not yet. Discovery is still continuing. I don't know if we're going to be able to prove that he was negligent.
But that's what you would have to prove. That's the question.
Yes.
All right. Well, suppose you win the case here now. Will you continue to go after the driver? I mean, do you want to be able to continue, let's put it this way, do you want to be able to continue to go after the driver as well?
I think that we should be able to if we wish.
You might get all your damages from the uninsured motorist coverage.
Yes, that's possible. I mean, we could continue with the lawsuit, or if there's not sufficient evidence of negligence on the part of the driver, I mean, it's possible that the lawsuit would not go forward. But to me, regardless of whether that lawsuit goes forward, is not controlling in this case. Regardless of whether we pursue the driver, I think that there should be uninsured motorist coverage available here.
Is there any dispute in regard to whether or not the brakes indeed failed on this vehicle?
There was an extensive police report done, and it seems to indicate that the brakes were not maintained very well, that there was a leak in the master cylinder and other things.
So that's really the basis for your allegation in regard to lack of appropriate maintenance?
Yes.
You could have brought these two suits together, couldn't you?
We could have, yes.
You chose not to?
Yes.
And then you went in and brought in the second lawsuit?
Yes.
But it should, from your perspective, doesn't make any difference whether you bring one lawsuit or two lawsuits. Is that right?
It doesn't make any difference whether we sue the driver or not.
It might under Hemmerly, though.
Pardon?
It might under Hemmerly.
Under their definition.
Right.
Yes.
So why do they think they're wrong? I mean, you're in a bad position because you got a precedent of Hemmerly, but it's pretty good because the court, which set forth that precedent, is backing away from it.
I think the Hemmerly decision was decided incorrectly. The Court of Appeals first looked at the statute and tried to determine what the statute required in terms of what an uninsured motor vehicle is. Part of the reason I think that the court looked at the statute first is the parties in that case directed the court to look at the statute. I think what the court should have done is looked at the language of the policy first. The policy defined an uninsured motor vehicle as a vehicle which was not covered by liability insurance. The court found an ambiguity, however, because the policy used the term uninsured motor vehicle, but it also used the term uninsured motorist. And when it interpreted that ambiguity, the court said that we're going to interpret the policy language the way we earlier interpreted the statute. I think that if the court had interpreted the policy first, once it found an ambiguity, it should have construed that ambiguity in favor of the insured. And if it had done so, it would have found that there was an uninsured motor vehicle because there was no coverage on the vehicle. And if the court had come to that conclusion, it would not have needed to interpret the uninsured motorist statute, and it would not have needed to adopt the definition of uninsured motor vehicle, which it did. When it interpreted the policy, after it had interpreted the language of the statute, it said we have to interpret the language of the policy consistent with the way we earlier interpreted the language of the statute. I think in doing that, the Court of Appeals overlooked the principle that a policy of uninsured motorist coverage can provide more coverage than that mandated by the statute. So I think it was incorrect for the court to interpret the policy to provide exactly as much coverage as it thought the statute required. If it had confined itself just to the language of the policy, it could have found coverage, and that coverage could have been more than what was required by the statute.
Ms. Antoine, since you've told us that there's factual distinctions between this case and Hemmerly, do you think to adopt your position we would have to overrule Hemmerly?
I don't think you necessarily have to overrule it. You could try to limit the ruling in Hemmerly and its definition to a case factually similar to that case where the driver is claimed to be negligent and the driver had liability coverage. But I think it would be better for the insurance law in the states if you were to overrule Hemmerly because of the fact that I think it was decided incorrectly. for the reasons I stated, because I think it went about the issue in the wrong order. It should have looked at the policy first, and then possibly the statute, if the policy did not provide the coverage mandated by the statute.
The deceased had two policies?
Yes.
And you want to collect under both of those policies?
Well, I think that we can. Under the former version of Section 631.43, sub 1, which is the statute which has been interpreted to allow stacking of multiple uninsured motorist coverages, I think that we should be able to collect the limits under both policies.
Is that because premiums were paid under both policies? In other words, is that because your clients paid for premiums under both policies that you're saying they ought to be able to recover under both?
Well, there were two policies and two premiums were paid.
That's not an issue here, though, in this case.
No, it's not.
The only issue is the uninsured motorist.
Yes. In summary, I think that the Hammerly case should be overruled, because to apply the definition of uninsured motor vehicle in the Hammerly case would have the result of leaving Mrs. Hull with no source of compensation for the damages caused by the negligence of the owner of the pickup truck.
Before you conclude your summary, could I have one more question, please?
Sure.
This is with respect to 632.32 sub 4 sub A. And the language requires uninsured motorists for the insurance for the protection of persons injured who are legally entitled to recover damages from owners or operators. Now, I notice that you rely on that statute and that precise language in your brief, in the latter part of your brief, page 2728. And you say that this is an owner and therefore she's entitled. But why couldn't that statute be interpreted to mean from either owners or operators, but not both? And here you've got an operator that's insured and therefore you're out.
To interpret it as you can recover from either one or the other,
but not
would
both,
be contrary to the interpretation of the statute that this court has written in several cases. But the uninsured motor statute has to provide the injured person put the injured person in the same position he or she would be in if the person claimed to be the uninsured motorist or covered by liability insurance.
Now, if you read it the way Justice Babbitt stated, then you'd have to bring a lawsuit against both, because you don't know in the beginning who has uninsured motorist and is liable. I mean, who is uninsured and is liable? Because if you pick the wrong person, you're stuck. So the insurance company will have to defend anyway.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I just want to check my understanding. Thank you, Ms. Antoine. You'll have several moments for rebuttal. Mr. Favre, representing State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Ms. Antoine. My name is Peter Farb. I'm with the Appleton firm of Gabriel Williams and Farb, and I represent State Farm. It's been said that we are a nation of law, and that I think the events of Washington, D.C. in the last few months have shown that even the president is subject to the law. And in our system of laws, this court has many different functions. And I think the function that is important here today is a fairly narrow one, that is to interpret legislation, what legislature meant when it enacted 632.32 4 sub A. there are numerous decisions that this court has stated that that is its function when looking at legislation. It's not to create law, but to interpret what the legislature has done. This court, I guess, has stated it best when it said it's to discern the legislative intent and give effect to that intent. Now, there were some arguments that were raised in petitioner's reply brief in this court that were not raised before, and I would like to address those for just a moment or two, if I might, since I have not had a chance to do that.
Can you speak up a little bit,
please? I'm sorry. There are some arguments in petitioner's reply brief that I have not seen before, so I have not had a chance to address them, and I would like to touch base on those for a moment or two.
Well, could you begin first, counsel, please, and I'm sorry to interrupt so early in the argument, but it's Thursday afternoon.
Now I get it.
Those are the kind of distinctions we make up for.
I understand.
Before you address those arguments, I was hoping that you would address first what you perceive to be the intent of the legislature in enacting uninsured motorist provision.
I think that the intent of the legislature in enacting the statute that is relevant to this case was to provide at least one source of recovery for persons who are injured. And that, in essence, I don't think it's impossible to align that with previous decisions of the court in that if there is coverage on one of the entities, such as the driver in this case, then the uninsured motorist statute simply does not kick in. It doesn't apply because there is a source of recovery already.
All of us on this court, including myself, buy uninsured motorist protection, and I presume we all buy as much of it as we can, given the astronomical costs that could befall us with an accident. And when I buy it, I, up to this point, have thought that I'm buying it in order to make sure that if a negligent tortfeasor, a person that's responsible for my injuries arising out of the use of an owner of a vehicle, doesn't have insurance, my insurance that I've bought will essentially attach to him or her.
In a sense, that's true, and in a sense, it's not. It's not true in the sense that you don't have a choice to buy UM, really, because the legislature has said that it's required. Right? You may have a choice as to the level that you purchase, for example, but if you put the shoe on the other foot, so to speak, State Farm doesn't have the option to say, we'll sell you, we're not going to sell you a UM policy here. If they're going to sell the policies, as they talk about, for providing liability, generally speaking, they have to include it. They don't have a choice. And I think...
But I grant you that, counsel, but obviously, you know, from my standpoint, I think that I'm being taken care of. If there's two tortfeasors in an accident that have caused me injuries, and one's only got $25,000 worth of insurance, and the other one has none, my policy operates to act as if that person who has none has the limits that I have bought.
I don't think that that's really, at least from my reading of the statute and the case law, particularly Hemmerly and Schwokert or Schwokert or however it's pronounced, I don't think that that's what they really meant.
Well, what do you suggest the Justice Babbage do in this terrible situation he's got?
Well, in a terrible situation, there is another policy which you can purchase, which is underinsured motorist coverage. And for the person who only has the 25 limits, then your underinsured motorist coverage takes up the gap there.
So you're just saying a different insurance policy, a different provision in the insurance policy will protect him. He's just trying to rely on the wrong one, in your opinion.
In a sense, I suppose that's true.
So then he can collect if one of them is liable for $25,000, the other is out because they're uninsured, the uninsured motorist, which in your theory doesn't pay. He's got injuries of $75,000 for the 50, he should look to the underinsured.
uninsured motorist cover.
But the legislature does not mandate underinsured.
No, it doesn't. But your question, I think, was premised on you being a sophisticated insurance consumer, such as, I'm worried about what might happen to me out there, so I want to make sure I've got enough coverage.
And no matter how sophisticated you are, State Farm isn't going to change the terms of their policy for you, are they?
Not sure I understand.
Well, I suppose I look at the standard form and I say, oh, no, I don't want that, and I want to strike out a few words and add some things. You're not going to be happy doing that.
Well, that may be true, and I know there have been cases that have talked about whether insurance contracts in Wisconsin are contracts of adhesion. It's my understanding this court has said they are not. And certainly there are, I would guess, hundreds of auto insurers in this state or selling in the state.
Yeah, I just have to go to different company.
Certainly.
I think we can carry to an absurd result, though, what's being suggested. That is, I'm the front driver, and I get hit on a rain or snowy or icy night by three cars. The next two behind me have got $1 million of coverage each, and the fourth car is uninsured. And that just seems to me that you should have no right to also sue your own insurance company.
Personally speaking, I would agree with you. I think the Collicott case says otherwise. It says if you're involved in an accident with multiple vehicles, and one of those vehicles is not insured, then you do collect uninsured motorist coverage. But of course here, we're only talking about one vehicle, and that's the distinction. That's why at the trial court, the petitioner argued the Collicott case, and I argued it doesn't apply because there's only one vehicle. There's not more than one, and I think that's the difference.
Mr. Farr, let me follow up, if I might, on Justice Babbage's questions a couple of minutes ago. You mentioned the Schwalkert case, and we're all having trouble with how do we pronounce it, but there's language at page 346 of that case that talks about uninsured motorist coverage being effective where the tortfeasor has no liability insurance. Now, in this situation, the situation before us, it's my understanding that that's exactly the allegation, that the tortfeasor was the owner who didn't maintain the vehicle. The tortfeasor had no liability insurance. Given the language of Schwalkert, why shouldn't indeed there be uninsured motorist protection?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last part.
I said, given the Schwalkert decision and given the facts in this case, why shouldn't there be uninsured motorist coverage here?
Well, as I read Schwalkert, and I apologize, I have four pages of it here, but I don't have
one. And not that.
You're quoting at page 351, they faced this exact question, and they said, I'm quoting here, since Jeffrey had coverage under his own policy, the Schwalkert's uninsured motorist coverage did not apply to this accident. Jeffrey did not fit the definition of an uninsured motorist either under the policy or under section 632.32 stats, and then they cite Emmerich. So as I read Schwalkert, what they're saying is, if they're following Hemmerle, and they're saying if one of these categories has coverage, then it's not uninsured.
Now, it's my understanding that in Schwalkert, we were dealing with allegations involving one tortfeasor. That tortfeasor was the driver. No. And is that not correct?
No, that's not correct. When you look at the beginning part of the case, and this was something that went back and forth in the briefs, page 337, which is one of the pages I have, it says that these damages resulted when Jeffrey Loth negligently failed to stop at a stop sign. Jeffrey's negligence was stipulated to be the sole cause of the accident in exchange for a release of all the personal liability of Jeffrey or John Loth, his father. And when you go back to look at the...
Well, but the stipulation was that he was the sole tortfeasor.
That's what it says, but that's in return for, in essence, letting the two individual tortfeasors off personally. When you look at the case, the father was sued. The father was the owner of the vehicle, and he was sued as well. But in terms of And obviously, it's trial tactics. Why, you know, exactly why it happened, I don't know that anybody has really dealt with. For purposes of trial tactics, it was stipulated that the son who was driving was the only tortfeasor. But when you look at the case, both of them were there. The owner, who was the father, and the son, who I think was an adult.
But we can't ignore that stipulation, obviously.
Well, in the sense of law of that particular case, I think that's true. You know, the Supreme Court, you went on to say, you know, and later, and I realize you personally were here at that point, but you went on to say that Jeffrey didn't fit the definition of an uninsured motorist. You know, even though there was a question about coverage on the vehicle versus coverage on the driver, so.
Would this be a good time for you to get at the points you wanted to make when you stood up?
I'm happy to answer your questions. The main surrey rebuttal or rebuttal, if you will, that I wanted to touch on was the petitioner's citation to the Kruzicki case, K-R-U-Z-I-C-K, that's 209 Wisconsin, section 12. That has to do with, and I guess I need to step back for just a moment and place it in context. The statute is enacted. Hemmerly decides what it means. Schwokert later comes along and relies on Hemmerly, and as far as I can tell, says it's a good decision. The question then becomes, because the legislature has not changed that portion of the statute, does that then show us that, in fact, that was their intent? And it's the Kruzicki case that the petitioner then relies upon to say, well, that's not always the case. And the problem I have with the Kruzicki case is that those facts certainly are distinguishable. The argument, as I understand Justice Crooks made in his dissent, was that there were no legislative changes in the meantime. And, of course, the problem was that the case was still on appeal. It had been decided by the Court of Appeals, and you folks had not either granted the petition or decided it yet. And so the majority responded then saying, well, the fact that the legislature has been silent doesn't mean anything. But I think, you know, that's not the case here. That's not the situation. Generally, it was decided in 1985. Schwokert came along 2 years later in 1987, and in essence, as I read the cases, it's been silent since then. There have been, as I point out, changes that the legislature has made in this very paragraph that we're here to argue about. They deleted one sentence from the end, so they are obviously, and that was in 1985, Act 21, I believe it was, they're obviously tuned into this particular issue. They looked at that exact paragraph. They made changes in that paragraph. They are presumed to know of Hemmerly and Schwokert, but they didn't change the language that we're talking about here. And I think Justice Crooks, again, dissent in Kruzicki, quoting a couple of Court of Appeals decisions, says, where the legislature has made amendments to the statutory section in question and has not corrected the court's interpretation, the presumption of adoption or ratification is strengthened. And I guess my belief is that about the only way it could have been made any stronger is for the, thank you, suddenly got louder, is for the President of the Senate or the Speaker of the Assembly to have written a letter to the court saying, gosh, you guys did just the right thing in Hemmerly and Schwokert. I mean, that's all that's missing here. So I think in terms of the Kruzicki matter, that's in essence the main point. They had two other arguments that they first raised there. The second argument was that their attack on the doctrine of legislative acquiescence was that it was not conclusive, that the court still can look at other factors. And I guess I would agree with that, But as I understand it, the same would hold true of the rule of construction that you construe against the drafter of the insurance policy. That's not conclusive either. And as Hemmerly held specifically, and this court I think has stated on other occasions, that's also the rule of last resort. And I guess I would caution you before using that. The final case that they cite is State versus Johnson. And that's also on the legislative acquiescence matter. And this court, that's 207 Wisconsin 2nd, 239, this court then noted that it was interpreting the robbery statute and said that 24 years had gone by since a case that interpreted that, and the legislature had been inactive in that time, and therefore, in effect, the doctrine of legislative acquiescence allowed it to stand. Why they cite Johnson, I guess, is not real clear to me, because to me it seems to support my position. I guess that's the main reply I had, so to speak, to their reply brief. There are a couple.
Mr. Carnes, could I add? Isn't the essence of your argument that because the driver of the vehicle was covered by insurance, that satisfies the uninsured vehicle coverage?
Well, it negates the need for it, I guess I would say. Yes.
Negates the need for it.
Yes.
Is it automatic that because the driver has coverage, that coverage is available to the family of the deceased?
No, it's not automatic. I mean, there are occasions where fraud or collusion or something can negate coverage. I mean, generally speaking, I think that's true. It is available. I mean, there are rare occasions where a coverage defense has been raised, again, for fraud or collusion or intentional acts, perhaps, those types of things. But in the general mine run case, it is available.
Doesn't the plaintiff have to prove anything in the case against the driver? Other than the fact that the driver was driving?
Has to prove negligence, doesn't he?
Certainly, yes.
And what if there was no negligence?
Well, then they're not a tortfeasor, I guess.
And there wouldn't be any recovery?
No. Then there's only one tortfeasor left, at least under this scenario, theoretically, and that would be the owner, and he doesn't have insurance. Then uninsured motorists would kick in. But there hasn't, as far as I'm aware, in the materials I filed and supplementing the record, there is an insurance company involved and there are no coverage issues. There is coverage on the driver of the vehicle.
So your position is if they wanted your company, State Farm, to cover, to be in this lawsuit, they had to sue both, and you're liable just in case the driver under justice process example is found not negligent.
I don't know that they would necessarily have to sue both of us because...
Then why are you complaining? You're here, you're being sued. Maybe that's the important question then. We don't know if there's another insurance company out there.
Well,
you should bring in the driver in this lawsuit.
Well,
instead of saying I'm not liable, you're going to say, hey, he's liable.
Well, but see, we only become liable. Our liability is a contingent liability.
That's right. So bring in the person on whom the contingency rests.
Well, but I guess maybe I'm not following it. There is no question about insurance on the driver.
Well, we don't know if it's going to cover because we don't know if he's negligent. That's the point.
Yes.
I think the
well,
point.
Well, I guess my thought would be that there's a 3-year statute for personal injury. There's a 6-year statute for making UM claims.
So they could have sued the driver first, and if he's found not negligent, then they come back to State Farm, and then State Farm says, you're right, there's no coverage, there's no negligence.
So you're not saying that you're never liable here, you're just saying they sued in the wrong order.
No, I'm saying that absent a finding that there's no coverage on the driver or no negligence, then we aren't liable.
So they sued in the wrong order. They should have first found out if the driver is liable because of negligence. If it's yes and there's insurance, then you're home free. That's your position.
Sure.
If they say that the driver is not negligent or there's no coverage for one reason or other, then it's time to sue you.
Or most policies provide for binding arbitration, actually. But
well, whatever.
Yes.
Then they go after you. So they did it in the wrong order.
That's a good
idea. That's your position.
Well,
you don't like to think about it that way, but that really is, I think.
Well, to a degree, that's our position. I mean, I think, to me, and I'm not involved, obviously, in the case against the driver at this point, but to me, to have an auction company that is driving vehicles around where people are walking and to say that they're not negligent for not checking to make sure that there's a basic adequacy of the vehicle and they're driving it anyway, to me, I don't see how you're not going to find negligence there.
Well, it doesn't really affect you if a jury would find the driver not negligent and therefore his policy does not pay anything, because the ultimate fact, as your claim is, the owner didn't have insurance. So then would it kick in to the uninsured motorist? The fact originally remains the same. There was insurance. That doesn't guarantee collectability.
I apologize. I'm not sure I'm following.
The driver is insured, right? The driver is insured.
Yes.
What's the difference if the plaintiff can collect against the driver? All that is required in the statute is to be insured, not to be collectible.
Well, I suppose that's true. I guess I hadn't thought of it that way, but I would agree with that.
Well, then your position is if the driver is not negligent, but insured, involved in the accident, right? Not negligent and insured, then they can never sue State Farm as the uninsured coverage for the owner. I mean, that's what I understand Justice Steinmetz's question.
I guess I'm not really sure how to answer that, frankly.
My guess is that's not your position, is it? I don't know. You can tell me, but
no,
based on your other...
I guess I'm looking at... I've got the policy language here and the statute, and I guess my understanding has been that if there is insurance that's available to pay the plaintiff through one method or another, liability insurance, that is, then the uninsured motorist does not kick in. If there is no liability on the driver somehow, or, well, I guess that's really the question. If his coverage, if there is liability on the driver, but his coverage gets off for some reason because of collusion or intentional tort or whatever, I suppose the coverage then, the UM coverage, would kick in for what the driver should have had. So I don't know that it matters.
Well, Mr. Farr, I understand your position. I think I understand your position. You're saying that if there's liability insurance here from the driver, then uninsured motorist protection does not kick in. Correct?
Yes, until such time as there would be a finding of no coverage on him, for example.
Right, right. But now, how do you square that in terms of simply making sense? Because with a situation where instead of having an owner out here who was not the driver, and therefore the fact that the owner is not insured, there's no insurance, but if in fact there was another tortfeasor who was driving the car, who was driving a second car, then your uninsured motorist does apply. How do you square that? I'm correct in that assumption. If there are two vehicles...
Now you're talking about a two-car accident.
If there's a two-car accident, one car is insured and one car is not insured, uninsured kicks in. Does it not?
My understanding would be it does, under Calicut, yes.
Yeah, it does. So does that make sense to you?
certainly, because there's a whole separate vehicle involved. I mean, what the petitioner is doing here is saying we can fly spec this one vehicle, and if we can find any portion of liability on anybody somehow remotely connected with that vehicle, and they don't have insurance, then we get uninsured motorist coverage.
That's not their position. The position of the statute is owner or operator. Now, it's limited to either the owner or the operator.
I agree with that, but at least in the courts below, petitioner did not.
But that's clearly the words of the statute, right?
Yes, it says...
We can't go to the garage man or something like that and say, hey, the garage man wasn't insured, because the statute limits it to the owner or the operator.
The statute does, but petitioner was arguing for exactly what you just said, that if there's a mechanic who screws up and he doesn't have insurance, then they get UM coverage.
She didn't seem to be arguing that here, though.
Well...
Did you hear her argument?
No, I agree. She has not said that here, and that's part of the difficulty is their argument has changed a couple times.
You've argued, as I heard it, that there has to be an exhaustion, if you will, of the claim against the tortfeasor who is insured before a claim on uninsured motorists can be pursued. They have 6 years to pursue it. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, yes.
What if it isn't resolved, the underlying claim isn't resolved within the six-year period? Take this case. As I understand it, the accident is in 1994, 4 years ago. A lot of jurisdictions for a civil case to get tried takes at least, a lot of counties, as you know, at least 2 years plus from the time that it's really put on the schedule. So you could have a case, and if it went to appeal, that wouldn't be resolved for 6 years. Well, how do you deal with that?
I think, again, going back to an answer I gave earlier, typically, and then I believe in this case as well, arbitration is required, or is at least...
Outside of the six-year period?
Well, as I understand it, I don't know if there's a time limit on the arbitration. There is a time limit of 6 years for commencing suit.
Yes, well, but I mean, I think you're arguing both ways here. As I understand it, you're saying can't come against us until it's resolved. I'm giving you a hypothetical, which isn't so hypothetical. This case is already 4 years old, and we haven't got to the trial of the underlying action. 6 years passes, isn't resolved for a seven-year period. Come to you in 7 years and say, okay, we want to file uninsured motorist claim, and you say, no, 6 years is gone. I mean, that doesn't
happen. Well, there are two responses I'd have. First of all, part of the reason for the delay in this case is that they didn't sue what I believe is the responsible party until they had already lost at the trial court and had, in fact, lost at the court of appeals in this case. Second of all, routinely I have seen it where there is a request made for arbitration or for benefits, and the 6 years doesn't run, as I understand it, until it's a breach of contract. So if they don't demand arbitration until 5 years later and the company says, no, we don't agree to arbitrate, the 6 years starts then, because that's when the breach of the contract occurs. And frankly, as counsel for folks on a lot of these cases, what we do is we say, you know, we'll have a gentleman's agreement or a lady's agreement that we'll put this on hold until the underlying case is resolved.
You're telling me 10 years after an accident, I think back, I remember about 10 years ago, I got that little injury and I still have some problems. So I'm going to make a claim against UM because it doesn't start running. So 10 years after the accident, I make the claim and then I have another 6 years to go to arbitration. Is that what you're saying? Unlimited time to make the claim, and then once it's made, 6 years. That sounds like it's not correct.
I don't know that there's any law on the time for making a demand for arbitration. What I'm saying is, if there's a demand that is timely, and the insurance carrier, for whatever reason, wrongfully refuses, that's the date of the breach of contract, and that's when the six-year statute starts to run. But as a practical matter, again, I have seen it on numerous occasions where the UM carrier is placed on notice that there's a claim, and they say, wait a minute, here's an insured driver, go after them, and if that doesn't work out, then you come back and we'll be there. And it seems to me that, I mean, that's how this gets resolved routinely. So I don't see it as a problem. I haven't been aware of anybody who's, at least in my practice, who's ever given an agreement or an extension like that, and then they said, oh, wait a minute, you blew it, you didn't sue us. Because all the parties realize that it's better to work out the merits of the case against the adverse first, and if depending on what happens, there may not be a UM claim. I don't know if I've answered your question. Okay. Um, I guess in my conclusion, what I would say is that I think it's clear that Hemmerly does properly state the intention of the legislature. It's been on the books for a long time. It was approved by this court in Schwarkert. This court certainly had the chance. In Hemmerly, there was a petition for review filed that was denied. Like it or not, we have the practicing bar. Take that as your at least backhanded approval of the decision in that case. And then when it comes up again in Schwarkert and is specifically cited with approval and from all appearances relied upon, I think that has become the law. And in terms of State Farm's policy here, from my reading of it, the policy in State Farm's case is even closer to the statute than American Families. It tracks the language of the statute when it talks about ownership, maintenance, or use. That's exactly what State Farm's policy applies. The only difference is that the statute talks about owners or operators, whereas the State Farm policy says owners or drivers. And that's the only significant change in the language between the two. And when you compare that policy language with American Families' policy language, it's much closer to tracking the statute. And I think it's at base, if Hemmerly is correct, a correct interpretation of the statute, and Schwarkert is, then it seems to me unfair to change the rules at a later point when people have used the statutory language in their policy. And to declare, well, now it's ambiguous and used, doesn't strike me as fair.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. Well, Mr. Farb argued that this court had approved the Hemmerly definition in the Schwarkert case. Although the court cited the Hemmerly case with approval in Schwarkert, I don't think it decided the issue. In that case, the son was driving his father's car, and the son had insurance coverage under his own policy, but the vehicle wasn't insured. In that case, the son was the only person who was claimed to be a tortfeasor. The plaintiff in that case argued that there was no insurance coverage for the son because he didn't have his father's permission to use the vehicle. The court found that he did really have permission because he could give himself permission, so that there was insurance coverage. And then the parties seemed to agree that if there was insurance coverage for the son, that there was no uninsured motorist coverage. The court never really addressed an issue as to whether a particular vehicle was an uninsured motor vehicle or not. And in that case, the parties also conceded that if there was coverage for the son, the father would be covered under the same policy which covered the son. So there was never really any claim in that case that the father was an uninsured motorist. Mr. Farb also believes that this court should apply the doctrine of legislative acquiescence, in that the Hemmerly definition has stood since 1985, and therefore it cannot be limited or overruled in any way. I don't think that doctrine can be applied here. One of the main reasons is the interpretation of the term uninsured motor vehicle in the Hemmerly case conflicts with the purpose of the uninsured motorist statute. And I don't think that the legislature would expect this court to affirm a case where the application of the case results in conflicting with the legislature's statute. And also, another reason that the legislative acquiescence doctrine should not be applied here is because to apply that interpretation in the Hemmerly case would conflict with the purpose of the statute, which this court has defined in cases subsequent to the Hemmerly case. The Nicholson case is one case in mind, where the court held that the purpose of the statute is to provide a person injured by an uninsured motorist with the same coverage they would have if the motorist had liability coverage. Mr. Farb also seems to take the position that a person such as Mrs. Hull should go after people who have liability insurance coverage, and if they can't collect against those people, only use the uninsured motorist coverage as a last resort. This court, in cases subsequent to the Hemmerly case, one of note is the Nicholson case, held that that is not the proper interpretation of the uninsured motorist statute, that the uninsured motorist coverage should apply so as to put the injured person in the same position they would be in if they were injured by a motorist with insurance coverage. They rejected, specifically rejected, in a former interpretation of the statute that said that uninsured motorist coverage is basically last gap insurance, and that that uninsured motorist coverage should only apply when other sources are not available to yield the recovery that the person would otherwise get under the uninsured motorist coverage. So I believe that this court should overrule the Hammerly decision because it does not comport with the purpose of the uninsured motorist statute.
Thank you, Ms. Antoine. Thank you, Mr. Barb. The court is in recess until next week.
Let's remember, we all want to get the sheet of cards.